Pushkin.
Did you know some travel credit cards offer 10 times points on your spending? Don't miss out on big rewards for your next trip. NerdWallet lets you compare smart travel credit cards side by side, curated by an expert team of finance nerds. What could future you do with better travel rewards? A free flight? A room upgrade? Don't wait to make smart financial decisions. Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at nerdwallet.com. Reminder, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply. NerdWallet, finance smarter. Willie Nelson, Waylon Jennings, Kris Kristofferson. Before they were legends of outlaw country, they were lost souls looking for their sound. Don't miss Mandy Moore and the new scripted Audible original, The Boar's Nest, Sue Brewer and the birth of outlaw country music. Discover the true untold story of the extraordinary woman behind the outlaw country music movement and its biggest stars. Hear how one woman's vision and her tiny living room, far from Nashville's music row, became the epicenter of a musical movement. Mandy Moore as Sue Brewer in The Boar's Nest. Listen now at audible.com/The Boar's Nest.
The most innovative companies are going further with T-Mobile for Business. The PGA of America is helping lower scores and elevate fan experiences with AI coaching tools and 5G connected cameras. AAA is getting more drivers back on the road fast with location telematics. And the Las Vegas Grand Prix is powering race day operations with 5G connectivity, giving fans an experience at the speed they deserve. This is accelerating innovation with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.
Hey, everyone. Today we'll hear Rick Rubin talk to one of his all-time favorite vocalists, Tom Jones. In the mid-60s, when artists like the Beatles and Bob Dylan were starting a counterculture revolution, Tom Jones was getting his start singing old standards and 50s rock and roll at clubs around South Wales. Jones signed his first record deal in 64 and went on to release now timeless hits like It's Not Unusual and Green Green Grass of Home. With his soulful baritone and unique interpretation of American R&B and gospel, Jones became a mainstay at hip cabaret clubs in London, New York, and Vegas. It became commonplace for female fans to throw their underwear on stage during his performances. Of course, that later became a trope of the sex symbol crooner. On today's episode, Tom Jones shares stories with Rick from his remarkable career, including the first time he met Elvis on a movie set in Hollywood, and the night he turned down an invitation to join Little Richard on stage in L.A. out of fear he'd be deported. He also talks about why he thought Burt Bacharach's lyrics to What's New Pussycat were a joke the first time he heard them. This is Broken Record, liner notes for the digital age. I'm Justin Richmond. Here's Rick Rubin and Tom Jones.
The last time I saw you was, I want to say, seven or eight years ago in Las Vegas, backstage after you sang. And
that's right.
It was a beautiful night for me. I guess it was a regular night for you because that's what you do all the time.
It was a long time ago, though. It was longer than, because I haven't been to Vegas now for about 12 years.
Could it be that long? I can't believe it.
Yeah.
Amazing.
I don't think you'd done the Johnny Cash albums either. At that time.
Really? I must have.
And you hadn't done the, I know you hadn't done the Neil Diamond one.
Really? Is that true?
Yeah. Because I remember when the Neil Diamond one, I called him and said how good I thought the album was. And it's quite a while after I saw you.
Yeah. That was a good one. I like that one too.
Yeah, I love that album. I think it's the best album he's ever done.
Wow. That's incredible.
Yeah.
I loved him since young, like you. You know, like same era of I saw you guys both when I was a kid growing up on TV.
Yep.
And I got to see you perform when I was young. My parents brought me to see you at Westbury Music Fair on Long Island. So I saw you, probably sometime in the 70s, I would imagine. Would that make sense?
Yep. But with Neil, you know, we started at the same time in the 60s. I remember meeting him in London. In 65, you know, when I had It's Not Unusual, and he was writing then for different people, you know.
Yeah.
I think he had done something with Lulu. Yeah, he'd done a few things with British artists at the time.
Tell me about the world of music Was 1963 when you started?
Yeah, when I went to London in 63. I recorded in 64. I did a song called Chills and Fever, which was a sort of a rock and roll thing, because in those days, Peter Sullivan, the guy that became my recording manager, he saw me singing in dance halls and clubs in Wales, and I was doing basically 50s rock and roll. And so he thought that would be the way to get me going, you know. Yeah, so we found this song called Chills and Fever, which was done by a guy called Ronnie Love, I think his name was. It was an R&B record, you know, and we made it more into a rock and roll record. And I mean, it sort of registered slightly, but nothing. It was a hit in Australia. I remember that. So then we had to rethink, you know, and I was doing demos in London. Gordon Mills was my manager, and he was writing for Leeds Music. And so I used to do demos for different things. And then he wrote It's Not Unusual, and I did the demo on it. It was for Sandy Shaw, really, who had some hit records at the time. And so when I heard it, I said, this is it. You know, this sounds like a hit record to me.
Yeah.
And then Peter Sullivan said, well, if you're going to do it, you know, we got to pump it up, because it was a milder song. You know, it's a sort of a Brazil 66 type feel to it. But I was basically 50s rock and roll music. That's what I lived, really, you know, before that. But then you get strange with recordings, as I'm sure you know, but it sort of starts to lay a path, you know, because I did It's Not Unusual with brass. People wanted, or the record company anyway, Decca Records, wanted more of the same. And then Burt Bacharach did What's New Pussycat for the Woody Allen film. And there I go again, you know, with a pop record. And I, all the time, I wanted to do like Wilson Pickett, you know, and I was into soul music by that time. But I could never get an original song. You know, if I was going to do a soul type thing, it would have to be covers, you know. So What's New Pussycat? Then we didn't know what to do after that. So then I did the Green Grass of Home. So it's always different things sort of pop up.
Originally, it was more 50s rock and roll for you.
Yeah, oh yeah. When I was doing the clubs and pubs and dance halls in Wales, where I come from, South Wales, that's what I was doing. You know, it was Jerry Lee Lewis and Elvis Presley and Fats Domino, Chuck Berry, Little Richard. They were the ones, you know. And when I listen to the record, those records today still sound fantastic.
Yeah, Little Richard records sound like they're going to explode. They're so exciting.
Oh, you know, to get away from those, sometimes I'll try and listen to the radio nowadays, you know, which there's some decent stuff. But once I start playing 50s rock and roll music, I got a job to get away from it.
Yeah.
As far as listening is concerned. And boogie records. You know, I love boogie woogie. You know, Pete Johnson and Albert Hammonds and Mead Lux Lewis, Professor Longhair, you know, those people. I love that kind of stuff.
How about the blues? Has the blues been a part of your repertoire as well, listening?
Yeah. Well, when I was young, you see, I was always listening to voices. I liked the way people sounded. I think that's what it was. So, like, when I heard Mahalia Jackson sing, I thought, my God, you know, those gospel songs came to life. I mean, we were singing those songs in chapel, in a Presbyterian chapel. Same songs. You know, a lot of them were, but not like that. So that got me interested in black gospel music and rhythm and blues, you know. But mostly New Orleans type, you know, I loved Louis Armstrong. I loved that stuff that was coming out of New Orleans. The blues, as far as the blues were concerned, Lead Belly I'd heard, but my favorite was always Big Bill Brunsey, was always more musical to me than some of the other ones that came a little later, like Muddy Waters, you know, and there was more of sort of electric blues. As with Big Bill Brunsey, he was playing acoustic guitar and like fingerstyle, you know, more than, but very rhythmic, you know, he was very rhythmic within himself. Just playing and singing. So I, as far as the blues was concerned, I would say Big Bill Brunsey was the one that I was listening to there.
Have you ever considered making a gospel album?
Yeah, well, when I did Praise and Blame, you know, with Ethan Johns, we did some Ain't No Grave, you know,
yeah,
Gonna Hold My Body Down, and we did quite a few gospel songs.
Beautiful.
Then, but I've never actually recorded a whole album of gospel songs, which it could happen, and the same thing with blues.
Yeah.
There's a lot of big Bill Brunsey stuff that I would love to do. There's a lot of possibilities.
Yeah.
It's always, as you know, it's where do I go from here?
Yes.
You know, what? But you've got to have some kind of theme. You've got to have some kind of an idea to link the stuff together, as opposed to just going in there and recording a mishmash of material. Because I like so many different types of songs as well, you see?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I used to love Frankie Lane, you know, when Frankie Lane came out. So I like those big sort of soulful ballads, you know, like I Believe.
Yeah.
But then again, that's of a gospel nature as well, you see?
In the early days in Wales, what was the music scene like? You were of rock and roll age. It's funny because the perception of you is not in the world of rock and roll.
No, I know. But as I was saying, recording those songs in my early recordings, it's not unusual, you know, and then what's the Pussycat? It sort of takes you that way. But my love has always been 50s rock and roll music before anything else.
Yeah.
Jerry Lee Lewis is still Jerry Lee Lewis.
Yeah, and I suppose age-wise, you were probably contemporary with the Beatles, no?
Yeah, well, the same thing. See, we were all the Beatles, the Stones, Van Morrison, Joe Cocker. We were all listening to those early, you know, 50s rock and roll music.
Yeah.
When anybody has asked, what was the first rock and roll record? It's always Rock Around the Clock from Black Bo Jungle,
yeah,
you know, from the movie. And all, everybody will tell you the same thing, of our age. And then when I realized that when I'd asked musicians about them later on, that things were mic'd individually, which they had never done with a rhythm section before. That's why they sounded so hot. So, you know, I remember asking Count Basie about it. You know, I said, what do you think of rock and roll music? You know, why do you think it sounded so different? He said, because they spent more money on it. He said, this all comes from rhythm and blues, really.
Yeah.
But those early black records that were being made, they didn't have the money to spend, you know, to make them sound like the records then that came later. Like when Little Richard then came on the scene, they were black records still, you know, but they sounded much better than the earlier records, you know, that the black entertainers recorded.
Living in Wales, was it hard to hear this music? How did you get to hear it?
Yeah, well, on the radio, you see, but the BBC, they had to play everything because we didn't have any regional stations. You know, we didn't have a gospel station or a country station. It was all the BBC. And then there was a station that came out of Germany called Radio Luxembourg, mm-hmm, that you could get if you had the right wireless, you know, the right radio set, you could pick that up. And they played more blues, gospel, country than rock and roll. And when I heard something and I thought, what is that? You know, why is that different? Because, you know, I was born in 1940, so the big band music was still being played, mm-hmm, you know, and Frank Sinatra and those singers that sang with bands. You know, there were big bands that were being, so that was the music. And Vera Lynn, you know, in the war and after the war, those songs that Vera Lynn would sing. So they were the things that I heard. But then you'd get an occasional American R&B, you know, or blues record that would come on, or gospel, you know, and I knew it was different. And a lot of people of my age, we were being influenced by that. You know, when you heard it, you think, that's different. Why is that different? Why does that sound like that? Who is that? And you look into it then.
What were the other big voices from your youth that you just felt like, these are the voices that are inspiring?
Well, Frankie Lane was definitely one. And Billy Daniels, an old Black Magic, you know, when he sang Old Black Magic, I get a kick out of you.
Yeah.
You know, that was different. That he sang it different to what Frank Sinatra did. Billy Eckstine, when he did I Get a Kick, it was like, you know, he meant that he was really getting the kick. He was, you know, he had a way with the words. So, and Tennessee Ernie Ford. When I first heard those boogie records that Tennessee Ernie Ford did, Catfish Boogie and Black Betty Boogie, and I think they were the beginning of that rock and roll sound, you know, that was being done, because it was a heavily piano. I think it was Moon Mulligan was playing piano, I think, on those records. So that they were definitely different, but they were boogie records, you see.
Were you a fan of any of the previous generation singers like the Sinatras that came before rock and roll as well, or not so much?
Not so much. Afterwards, funnily enough, I learned to appreciate Sinatra when I got older.
Mm-hmm.
No, I wasn't a fan of that music.
Mm-hmm.
You know, rock and roll, when rock and roll kicked in, it was like a breath of fresh air. You know, it was like, oh my God, you know, this is tremendous. And all the musicians, you know, and singers at the time hated it, you know, the established singers, because they couldn't do it.
Yeah.
You know, and it's a strange thing, because I was talking to musicians when I was in the 50s. I was working in a glove factory making gloves, and all these glove cutters, these guys that were making the gloves by hand, they were musicians, you know, they were amateur musicians playing in dance bands and everything. And rock and roll would come on the radio, and I would be like with the ruler, you know, banging this desk I used to work at to do 1, 2, 3 o'clock. It was like, Jesus. So they said, what is that crap, you know? And I said, well, what's the matter with you? It's tremendous. And they were trying to get me to listen to, you know, other music. And I said, no, this is it. And they said, well, it's nothing. It's easy to do. Then I would go and watch them in these bands that they were playing in. And they would try and play them, you know, and they couldn't do it. They just could not do it. It's a strange thing. Elvis Presley used to talk about it when he first went on television, to try and get those TV bands in America, like the Dorsey Brothers. When he went on there, they couldn't play it.
Yeah.
Quincy Jones was telling me, he said it wasn't happening.
Yeah.
And until he brought his rhythm section in, you know. So it's a strange thing. And boogie, you know, boogie music is the same. You know, a lot of piano players, they don't think much of boogie woogie, but get them to play it.
Yeah, it's a feel thing. It's like, if you don't feel it, it's not about playing it right. It's about feeling it. And same. The way you sing, even though you have essentially what feels like an operatic voice, there's a groove always when you're singing. That's why I asked about the blues earlier. It's like, it feels like there's a grooviness always.
Yeah.
In your interpretations, you know?
There's always a blues element on all the songs that I've done.
Yeah.
You know, even the ballads, I tend to lean towards bluesy notes, you know, whenever I can inject them in there.
Yeah. No, it sounds more like you, and it makes it feel more personal, and it makes it feel more soulful and more from the heart than just singing the notes of the song, you know?
Yeah. Well, that's what I felt about a lot of the singers that came prior to that, you know, the big band things. And the songs didn't register with me, except for the ballads. I mean, I always loved My Funny Valentine, and I always loved Autumn Leaves.
Your recording of Autumn Leaves is staggering.
Oh, thank you.
I love it.
I was 24 then.
So good.
Yeah. Well, see, that first album that I did, you know, Along Came Jones, I had to do that song. I always loved that song since I was a child. And but then, you know, Memphis, Tennessee is also on there, you see?
Yeah.
And I Need Your Lovin', you know, it's like, whoa, 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 whoa. Dan, dan, dan. You know, it's like on the same album.
Yeah. How old were you when you went to London?
I was 23, and then I recorded that. I was 24.
And how did it work out for you to get signed? And tell me the first experience of going to London.
Well, when I did an audition, you know, they'd heard me sing demos. You know, we were sending demos to different record companies. And Decca Records, Peter Sullivan, he heard the demo that I sent and asked me, would I come to London and do an audition? You know, which I did. And he said, fine, we'll sign you if you fancy it, you know, for three singles.
Mm-hmm.
It's like three strikes and you're out. You know, it's like you get three. Yeah, so we did Chills and Fever, because he'd heard me singing, you know, and saw me in these clubs when he came to see me, and thought a rock and roll record would be the way to go. So that was the first one. And then It's Not Unusual was the second record.
Wow.
So then I was flying then.
Amazing. And that essentially has been, I guess it's the song most associated with you still to this day of everything, I think.
Yeah, it is. Well, I think maybe because I had a TV show in the late 60s, early 70s, and we always opened the show singing that live. You know, I sang it every time live on the show. So I think people heard that, you know, more than anything else. Because anytime anybody sees me, if they're going to sing something at me, you know, it's not unusual.
Tell me about the TV experience. What was that like, having a TV show?
It was fantastic because I could then get people on that I wanted, like Jerry Lee Lewis was on one of the shows, Little Richard was on the shows, and then a lot of Motown action. Oh, Stevie Wonder had just come on the scene.
Great.
Ray Charles came on. Janis Joplin came on, and she wouldn't do variety shows in those days. You know, she said, "I'm only doing it because it's you."
Wow.
And I said, "Well, thank you." And we did it. We did a hell of a duet together. I remember.
Great. Did you do duets with everyone who came on?
Everybody, yes.
Wow, fantastic.
Yeah, it was tremendous. And Wilson Pickett, you know, we did Hey Jude and Barefootin'.
Great.
And Ray Charles, you know, and yeah, everybody that was around in those days. But I had a push for Little Richard and Jerry Lee Lewis, yeah. You know, because they said, oh, 50s rock and roll. And I said, look, please. Once the show was a success, I had more of a say in it. I mean, I wanted to get Chuck Berry. I wanted to get Fats Domino. You know, I wanted to get a lot of people. But if they weren't selling records at the time, it was difficult to get them on.
We have to take a quick break, but we'll be right back with more from Rick Rubin and Tom Jones. As listeners to this show, you probably consider yourself pretty smart. But how smart is your wallet? When you're looking to upgrade your wallet, it's time to turn to NerdWallet. Their expert team of nerds has the financial smarts to help you find the right financial products for you. Before NerdWallet, you might have paid for vacations with whatever was in your wallet, but you could have been missing out on miles you didn't even know you were leaving on the table. Now you can get a new card with more miles and more upgrades. What could future you do with more travel rewards? A hotel upgrade? Lounge access? Wherever you go next, make it happen with a smarter travel card. Don't wait to make smart financial decisions. Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at nerdwallet.com. NerdWallet. Finance smarter. As with all cards, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply.
Snag a Job is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snag a Job is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position: warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snag a Job's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text SNAG to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
Willie Nelson, Waylon Jennings, Kris Kristofferson. How did the biggest names in outlaw country start a musical revolution? Through one woman's vision from one tiny living room. Don't miss Mandy Moore as Sue Brewer in the new scripted Audible original, The Boar's Nest, Sue Brewer and the Birth of Outlaw Country Music. Discover the true untold story of the extraordinary woman behind the outlaw country music movement and its biggest stars. Brewer helped shape the sound and soul of country music as we know it today, despite never picking up an instrument herself. Lovingly dubbed The Boar's Nest, Sue's place was an intimate staging ground where a new breed of singer-songwriters, wounded souls, wayward upstarts, would spur each other on to tap into something bigger, realer. starring Mandy Moore and featuring Eben Moss Bacharach as Shel Silverstein and TJ Osborne as Johnny Cash, alongside a full ensemble cast. Audible invites you to enter the Boar's Nest and experience the rise of a musical revolution. One woman, one time, one place. The Boar's Nest. Sue Brewer and the birth of outlaw country music. Listen now at audible.com/theboarsnest. We're back with more of Rick Rubin's conversation with Tom Jones.
How has the live experience changed from the time you were young to now? Just in terms of what's it like? What was it like when you started? What was monitoring like? What were the audiences like? What were the venues like? Talk about all of the different things you've seen over the years, because you've seen it change completely from the early days, I imagine.
Oh, yeah. Well, growing up in Wales, you know, I would sing, first of all, in school, you know, and in chapel. You know, that's where I learned to get in front of an audience, gatherings, you know, weddings and parties in the house. And I come from a large family with a lot of aunties and uncles and cousins, and we all were all singers, really. So there was a lot of singing going on in South Wales, and everybody loved singing, you know, and there were a lot of singers. So I would go and watch them when I was old enough to go into the local club, a workman's club. And there were singers that would get up there and sing songs, Frankie Lane songs, you know, and songs like My Mother's Eyes. You know, there was this big rugby player that used to get up there. And on a Sunday night, me and my teenage, you know, we'd say to, oh, come on, Glenog. His name was Glenog Evans. Great name. Huh? Come on, give us a song, Glen. You know, sing My Mother's Eyes. You know, sort of half making fun of him. Well, by the time he finished, there wasn't a dry eye in the place. You know, I mean, this fella could, like, I mean, he'd do it. You know, he'd just stand there and sing the shit out of My Mother's Eyes. And you think, oh, my God, that's it. So I got that. And then listening, as I say, to early, to the blues and to gospel and stuff on the radio, you know, that's what I was listening to. So I would incorporate that sometimes when I would get up and but I would always, like, for instance, when I took a rock and roll band into a workman's club, this was in the late 50s, they had never seen electric guitars in these clubs. Wow. and drums,
yeah.
You know. But I was singing with this local band in a YMCA. So I said to them, do you fancy coming into one of these workman's clubs? Because I used to play guitar and sing, you know, just like that in these clubs. Would you fancy it? Oh, well, we've never done it. I said, well, let's try it. So we go into this workman's club, and they had a habit, if they didn't like you, they would shout, pay him off, which means pay you not to play.
Yeah.
Just pay them and get them out of here. So when we were walking in with the amplifiers, you know, and the guitars and the drum, oh, Jesus Christ, you know, we don't want any of this crap. But I'd been there before, you see. I'd been to these clubs, you know, saying, and I'd get up and say, now, look, fellas, you know, please give us a shot here because you know me. Oh, yes, you were lovely, Tommy. Tommy's got a lovely voice, but we don't want this rock and roll. So I said to the band the first time, I remembered it so well, and I said, look, we'll start off with I Believe, funnily enough.
Yes.
I perfect. Said, we'll do I Believe. We'll do My Mother's Eyes. We'll do My Yiddish Mama. Because I heard Billy Daniels do it. So we would do these things. And then when everybody was like, yes, yes, we get it. We love it. All of a sudden, that, you shake my nerves and you rattle. You know what I mean? It was like, and they were like in, you know. So that was it.
Yeah.
And then in one night, I remember, from this pay 'em off when we first walked in, about halfway through the night, the fellow that booked us there, he said, if I call the police station and get an extension on the liquor, you know, the liquor laws, only went to like 11 o'clock. He said, if I could get the liquor law to 12, would you play until midnight?
Wow.
I said, yeah, if you pay us a few, you know, a few more pounds. So it was all in one night, from pay them off to could you stay till midnight and move all the tables and chairs back, and they all had a dance. You know, so we took rock and roll music into these workmen's clubs. And then they would have, they'd have dances on different nights of the week. And they were starting then to get a lot of younger people coming in, because it was a mother's and, you know, mum's and dad's place to start with, which you wouldn't get a lot of teenagers going into. So then they would start to come into these places. So we built up a reputation of playing pop music, really, you know. But a lot of 50s rock and roll, but it was in there, and they were loving it.
So cool. What a great story. I love hearing about the... And you ended up turning them on to rock and roll, and they ended up loving it.
Yeah. I thought to myself, if it's as long as it's presented properly, you know what I mean? As long as you go into their place rather than try to get those, you know, older people to come into a dance hall with a band playing all records being played, rock and roll records, you know, they wouldn't want to go and do that. But go to them with it,
yeah,
and present it in a way, as long as you can do some ballads as well, you know, as long as you can do stuff that they can understand, then you can do Johnny B. Goode, you know.
Yeah. What were the first performances you did once you were in London? What were those like?
I was doing them mostly in South Wales, and then came and did the record contract, you know, got the records out. Then I was playing quite a lot of American basses, because the Americans were still in Britain, you know, in the early 60s, you know, Air Force bases especially. So we would go and play these places. So I became very popular in these American Air Force bases when I had It's Not Unusual. Even before that, before I had a hit record, we would play them. And so I knew a lot of American songs, you see, which the GIs loved. So I was, you know, we sort of built up a bit of a reputation in these American servicemen's clubs.
What was the first time you came to the United States?
That was to do an Ed Sullivan show.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah, in early 65. It was amazing. It's Not Unusual came out in January the 22nd, 1965, and it was number one by March the 1st, you know, in Britain. And it was released in the States, and it went to number 10 on the 100, top 100. So then they booked me on the Ed Sullivan show, and he liked me. You know, so I think I did like 6 Ed Sullivan shows.
Wow, great.
Yeah, in 65. And TV had gone to color, so they couldn't transmit in color from New York. So the Ed Sullivan show had to go to Los Angeles to transmit in color. So then I went to L.A. and met Elvis Presley.
Wow, how was that?
Oh, tremendous. I mean, when I used to sing in these clubs in Wales, right, and I would do Elvis Presley songs, of course, and my friends used to say, "Wow, Tom, you know, you sing that as good as Elvis Presley." I said, "Well, I'll tell him that." And they said, "Oh, come on."
Sure.
You know, I said, "I got a feeling that I'm going to meet Elvis Presley." I had this feeling.
Yeah.
So when I went to Paramount Studios in L.A. to talk about a song for a movie, and they said, "Elvis is here today, and he would like to meet you." Jesus, I mean, this was in September of 65.
Wow.
You know, and I said, my God, I didn't even know that he knew anything about me. So I went on to the set, and he was in a mock helicopter. He was doing this, the Trades Fair, I think the movie was, with this little girl in this helicopter. And I'm standing in the back of the set, closed set, in this hangar, with the Memphis Mafia. And they stopped filming, and he waves. You know, so I'm like just standing there, and they said to me, "Elvis is waving at you." You know, "Oh, really?" So I waved back, and I had a song out at the time. It was my third single. It was a ballad called "With These Hands." And Elvis Presley come out of the helicopter, and he's walking towards me singing "With These Hands." And I thought, my God, if the boys back home could see me now, wow. You know. And he did it like Elvis Presley, you know, he pointed at me at the same time. You know what I mean? The way Elvis used to put his hand up, you know. And he's like, "With his hands, I will cling to you." And I thought, my God, here comes Elvis Presley singing my song. It was like, it was surreal. Unbelievable.
Unbelievable. It sounds like a dream, what you're describing.
A dream. Yeah. It was like a dream. And he said to me, "How the hell do you sing like that? Honestly." And I said, well... said, it's listening to people like you. He said, yeah, but I was brought up with it. You know, he said, I was going into black gospel churches as a boy. Do you have any black gospel churches in Wales? I said, no. You know, the only black people are down in Cardiff, in Tiger Bay, you know. But I said, it's from the radio that I've heard these songs. And he couldn't believe that I sound like I sound coming from where I came from.
Yes.
You know.
Yes.
Unless you were born there, you know, unless you were born there, he couldn't understand it.
Yeah, but in the same way, he got to hear it by being there. You got to hear it by hearing it on the radio. But it was still coming through one way or another. The inspiration was there, and you were exposed to it, and you got to feel it.
Yes, I knew the difference when I would hear Mahalia Jackson sing. You know, I would know the difference by the sound of her voice. So I was attracted to it. So just like Elvis was more attracted to black gospel churches as he was to white. You know, so you've got to be attracted to it in order to know what it is. And whether it's on the radio or whether it's live, you've got to go and think, well, what is that? You know, why is that sounding so wonderful and uplifting and real? That they sound like they mean it.
When you came to the U.S. to do the Ed Sullivan Show, would you also do live performances for audiences as well?
I couldn't bring my band, you see, so that was a problem. So I had nobody to do shows with, really. I remember the first time I met Little Richard was in 65, and I'd seen him do shows in England, mm-hmm. you know, before. But I was in Los Angeles doing the Ed Sullivan Show. So I said to my manager, I think I'll stay for a couple of weeks, you know, just to see what's happening in L.A. And so he said to me, well, look, your visa has run out now. You know, you only get a visa for a week to do the Ed Sullivan Show. Now, you know, if you're going to stay any longer than that, you're not on a visitor's visa. You're illegally in the country, right? Mm-hmm. So he said, for God's sake, don't get up in a club or something and draw attention to yourself. So I said, no, okay, I won't. So I go to see Little Richard. He's playing a club just off Sunset. So I'm backstage with him and we're chatting away and it was great. And so he introduces me when he's on stage and he asked me to get up on the stage. And I wanted to, because I knew every Little Richard song. So he said, come on, let's do this one. And I said, I can't do it, honestly. I would love to. And I still think of that now. To this day, wow. I think, my God, you know, why didn't I just do it? You know, but I was so scared of immigration, you know, and locking me up or something. Yeah. But then I got him on my TV show, you see. Then we did it.
Yeah.
You know, when it really mattered, you know, that the millions of people could then see it. So I got my wish at the end, but I would have loved to have just done that with him that night, you know, in 65.
Where did you do your TV show from?
From London, just north of London.
Great.
Yeah, Elstree Studios, and which is funny, where we do The Voice from now. You know, I'm a coach on the Voice UK.
Yeah,
and we do it from the same place.
Fantastic.
You know, I thought, my God, after all this time, you know, because that was like 69, 70, 71 when I did This Is Tom Jones. So it's still a pain in the ass to get there. You know what I mean? On the road, but it's great that I'm still doing it. You know, so I always think of that. I think if somebody had told me back then that I would be doing, still going to the studios in Elstree, now, it's a great feeling. It's a great, I love it.
So cool. If you're up for it, let's listen to my very favorite of your songs. Never Gonna Fall in Love is my favorite of them all.
Oh, thank you.
And let's listen to that together and then you can tell me anything you want to tell me about that one.
Okay.
I've been in love so many times, thought I knew the score, but now you've treated me so wrong, I can't take anymore, and it looks like I'm never gonna fall in love.
heard about you, I thought they were only lies. But when I caught you in his arms, I just broke down and cried. And it looks like I'm never gonna fall in love again. Fall in love. No, I'm never gonna fall in love. I mean it. Cast aside my pride. But when you fell for someone else, baby, I broke up all inside. And it looks like I'm never gonna fall in love.
So beautiful.
Yeah. Yeah.
So where'd that song come from?
Well, it was originally a song called I'm Never Gonna Cease My Wandering, which was from the Depression, you know, in the 30s. And I knew the song in Wales, in one of these workmen's clubs, as a fella used to get up and sing it, I'm Never Gonna Cease My Wandering. And I thought, what a great song that is.
Yeah.
You know, and so then I did some shows with a fella called Lonnie Donegan.
Yes.
In England.
Skiffle.
Yeah, Skiffle, yeah. Which was really old sort of lead belly type blues, you know, they called it Skiffle. So I did some shows with him and he said, look, I've just written a song and you would sing the shit out of it. So he played me a demo that he had done on it, Never Gonna Fall in Love Again.
Wow.
And I said, well, that's Never Gonna Cease My Wandering. He said, yes, it is. But he said, there's no chorus in Never Gonna Cease My Wandering.
I see.
You know, he said, we changed the words and then put that fall in love. Mm-hmm. That wasn't in the original. That wasn't there, which is the most commercial part of the song. And I said, oh, I got to do it. I'm going to try this. And so I said to Peter Sullivan, Lonnie Donegan has written this song and I want to do it. Okay, let's do it. So we did. And then when I did it, we used to get an acetate.
Yeah.
To take home, you know, to play it at home. And I took it home and we only had the one, right? So my wife took it to my manager's house. We lived close in England. She said, this is what Tom has just done. Well, they were fighting over this acetate. My wife and my manager's wife, to keep it that night. And my wife says, you know, it's my husband singing it. She said, yeah, but my husband manages it. So there was a big fight over this one acetate because that was the only copy that we had at that point. So to get two women fighting over, you know, over a song, I thought
it was a good sign.
Well, this is going to be a hit. And of course it was, thank God.
Yeah. It's such a great song, the energy of it. And yes, yeah, the hookiness of the chorus. It's got a real sing-along chorus.
Yeah.
And the vocal performance is just stunning. And you save the big note for the ends, almost like a Roy Orbison type. I mean, you're not singing like him, but the drama of building up
the structure
to the big note at the end, where you can't, like, you can't think it could get any more dramatic. And then you go there. It's so beautiful. What a great song.
Yeah, thank you.
We'll be right back after a break with more from Tom Jones and Rick Rubin. As listeners to this show, you probably consider yourself pretty smart. But how smart is your wallet? When you're looking to upgrade your wallet, it's time to turn to NerdWallet. Their expert team of nerds has the financial smarts to help you find the right financial products for you. Before NerdWallet, you might have paid for vacations with whatever was in your wallet. But you could have been missing out on miles you didn't even know you were leaving on the table. Now you can get a new card with more miles and more upgrades. What could future you do with more travel rewards? A hotel upgrade? Lounge access? Wherever you go next, make it happen with a smarter travel card. Don't wait to make smart financial decisions. Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at nerdwallet.com. NerdWallet. Finance smarter. As with all cards, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply.
Snagajob is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snagajob is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position: warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snagajob's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text SNAG to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
Willie Nelson, Waylon Jennings, Kris Kristofferson. How did the biggest names in outlaw country start a musical revolution? Through one woman's vision from one tiny living room. Don't miss Mandy Moore as Sue Brewer and the new scripted Audible original, The Boar's Nest, Sue Brewer and the Birth of Outlaw Country Music. Discover the true untold story of the extraordinary woman behind the outlaw country music movement and its biggest stars. Brewer helped shape the sound and soul of country music as we know it today, despite never picking up an instrument herself. Lovingly dubbed The Boar's Nest, Sue's place was an intimate staging ground where a new breed of singer-songwriters, wounded souls, wayward upstarts, would spur each other on to tap into something bigger, realer. Starring Mandy Moore and featuring Eben Moss Bacharach as Shel Silverstein and TJ Osborne as Johnny Cash, alongside a full ensemble cast, Audible invites you to enter the Boar's Nest and experience the rise of a musical revolution. One woman, one time, one place. The Boar's Nest. Sue Brewer and the Birth of Outlaw Country Music. Listen now at audible.com/theboarsnest. We're back with the rest of Rick Rubin's conversation with Tom Jones.
So talk more about live performances and where were the types of places you played once you started having success, and anywhere in the world.
Right. So it went from, I played these Air Force bases, American places, mm-hmm. in and around London. And we would play then ballrooms, you know, dance halls. People that had hit records in those days would play either theaters or dance halls. You know, one show a night. And some of them were on piers. You know, they used to have, you know, piers in seaside resorts.
Yeah.
And you'd have a dance hall at the end of the pier. Just like in the States, they had the same thing. And so we would then go and play these dance halls, in the summertime especially, on the end of these piers. But then we started getting interests coming from northern nightclubs in the north of England. So my manager and my agent, they said, we get a lot of requests from clubs, dance halls as well, and theatres as well, But these clubs now, you know, up in the north of England, they're putting on a lot of cabaret shows, which were like mini Vegas. When I went to Vegas, I saw, you know, the showrooms in Las Vegas, and they had things very similar, not as grand, but in the north of England, they had these nightclubs, you see, because they had casinos as well, you know, coming in there. So then I started playing these northern clubs. Well, they were like glorified workingmen's clubs that I had played in South Wales. So that's what happened. So it's been a problem, maybe a nice problem, I don't know. But my audience has always been a wide variety of people, you see. Mm-hmm. So I could play to kids, you know. Even in Wales, I could play a YMCA to teenagers on a Friday night and play a workingmen's club on a Saturday to adults.
Yes.
So the same thing basically has gone through my career. I would play the Talk of the Town, for instance, which was a huge nightclub in London in the 60s. And my agent, my American agent, came to see me there and he said, you got to play the Copacabana in New York. This is where it's at. So I said, okay. So then I played the Copacabana. And they were saying to me, funnily enough, they said, are you scared? You know, because it's like a lot of gangsters go in there. And I said, excuse me, if you've sung to coal miners and their wives and girlfriends, you know, the mafia doesn't scare me. It's the only difference is they got guns. You know, we didn't have guns. But to get over to those people, you know, you got to be able to deliver. So that was a big thing. In 68, I played the Talk of the Town in 67 in London. And then 68, I went into the Copa in New York. And it was tremendous, you know, to play a place where all these giants of American show business had played before.
Everyone.
Yep. Then that led to the Flamingo in Vegas and the Deauville in Miami. You know, so a lot of these clubs then, nightclubs. But then when my TV show hit, you know, it became so big that I started playing arenas.
Wow.
You know, basketball arenas, which people had never played before.
Yes.
You know, they'd never had musical venues. Maybe Madison Square Gardens, I think maybe was the only one. But all these big basketball arenas then, I started playing because the clubs got too small. Even though I was still playing Las Vegas, you know, I would still go back to Vegas.
Yes.
Which I used to moan about, because I used to say, how come I can make as much money in one night, you know, playing an arena, and I got to play, a week, two shows a night in Las Vegas? But they said, well, you know, that's the way it is.
Yeah.
But there you go. You do it. When you're young, you know, it's you get up in front of people, whether it's 2,000 or 20,000, you're performing, and that's what I do.
How did the audiences react to different songs in different parts of the world? Is it pretty consistent, or are there variations?
It's about the same. You know, I mean, I'm always aware if it's an English-speaking audience.
Yes.
If I'm in Britain or I'm in America or Australia or Canada or, you know, I'm aware of it. But all the European countries, you see all the different countries, they love all the stuff that I do.
Yeah.
You know, so I had a surprise that I had in the 70s when I went to Japan.
Yep.
So I said to promoter, are there any songs you think would go over, you know, more in Japan than... And he said, well, you have to do Danny Boy. I said, Danny Boy? Because I had done it on my TV show, you know, and they saw me doing Danny Boy. And I said, well, do the Japanese people understand the story? And he said, it's the emotion. They feel your emotion when you sing it.
Yeah.
So that was a big surprise to me that I had to keep Danny Boy in the show, in Japan especially.
Yeah.
Yeah. But when I play Israel, you know, my Yiddish mama in Israel is fantastic.
Fantastic. What's the part of your working life that you most enjoy?
Being on stage. That's the fun part. You know, that's the part. Like all roads lead to the stage.
Yes.
You know, everything that I do is it all sort of helps getting me to getting the people in there, you know, so that I can go on. But to be on the stage, giving it, you know, and receiving from the audience is a tremendous feeling. There's nothing else like it. It's like the closest thing to sex. You know, when you're going up the steps onto the stage.
Yes.
You know, just walking from the wings onto the stage. It's anticipation. It's the build-up before you make love. You know, and when you're in it, it's like, and then the coming down afterwards. You know, the relaxing part after you do the show.
Yeah.
If I go to dinner after the show, the food tastes better. The wine tastes better. Everything
beautiful
is better after that show.
Do you get nervous at all before going on stage?
Well, as I say, like before sex, you know, before making love, let's say.
Yeah.
You know, when you get that exciting feeling, you know, and then you get at it, of course. And then the only time if I get nervous is if I've got a cold or something, you know, that I feel that I'm underpowered and will it work? You know, will my voice work as well as I want it to? So I'll get a bit nervous then. But no, excited, yes, but nervous, no.
And how long does it take to come down after the show? Like, how soon can you sleep after a show?
Oh, a long time. I'm a night owl anyway.
I see.
You know, so show business is perfect for me because I live at night anyway. I always have done ever since I was a kid. So it's great. You know, I like to be awake at night.
Yes.
I think the world looks better at night. You know, when you're in a city, if you go out into a city in the daytime, it's bedlam. You know, you go out at night, things are much calmer.
Yeah, and most people are asleep, so there's less energy.
Yeah.
And it's a more peaceful world at night.
Yes, I think so. So it's great, you know, to go to a restaurant and, you know, and just relax with some friends. And it's lovely. It's a lovely feeling, the whole thing. And if I'm going to do a runner, you know, and get in a limousine and go somewhere else or jump on a plane, whatever it is, it's just a great feeling when you've achieved that show.
Are you ever surprised by what songs people react to that you've sung?
Yeah, going as big as they have.
Yeah.
You know, when I recorded The Green, Green Grass of Home, I heard the Jerry Lee Lewis version. I bought it on an album in 65 in the Colony Record Shop in New York, and it was called Country Songs for City Folk. And he was doing country songs of the day, you know, of that time.
Yeah.
And The Green, Green Grass of Home was a Porter Wagner song. So he did that. But that's the first time I heard it was Jerry Lee Lewis doing it. So I thought, oh, I got to do that. You know, that's a great song. You know, a surprise thing. You know, the man is in a cell dreaming about all this, which I thought was tremendous. So I thought, well, let's try it. And it became a monster. You know, it became huge.
Yeah.
Which I didn't expect. I thought it was going to be a good record. And I think that was thanks to Les Reed as well, who did the arrangement, because he, you know, he stretched it.
Mm-hmm.
He made it more of a pop record as opposed to a country record, you know. Yeah, so I didn't expect that. Oh, and What's New Pussycat, when I first heard that, when Burt Bacharach sang that and played it to me, you know, he played the piano and sang it live, I thought he was joking. I said, you know, you must be joking. I can't sing that. And he demoed the record and he said, take it away, have a listen and live with it and see what you think. And then I went in and recorded it. I still didn't think that it was going to be anything. And then, of course, you know, it was the Woody Allen film.
Yes.
The film was a hit. The song was a hit. And there you go.
It's a strange song. It's definitely a strange song.
Oh, the chord changes. I mean, I never heard chord changes like that. You know, da 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 da. What the? You know, what is this?
It sounds like a German drinking song. You know, like a beer hall song.
That's right. Exactly. So you don't know. You know, I didn't think that was going to be as anywhere near what happened to that.
Is it as much fun making music now as it's been from the beginning for you?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I think it's even more, you get more freedom now. As when I first started off, you'd get with an arranger, you know, you'd pick the songs, you'd set the key, you get the arrangement done. So all those things were done before you stepped into the studio. And then you'd have a 3-hour session to do three songs.
Yeah.
And like the first hour was taken up by getting the balance, and then you'd do the other two after that. So you'd have to get three songs within 3 hours.
Wow!
And studio time was very expensive, so they told me. You know, in the record company, so it was different. And they had a singles division, and then if you were selling a lot of singles, then you'd you could make an album. Then you'd go to the album section of the record company. So they had two different sections, and then you'd have a bit more time. But still, you'd still have to try and get three songs in 3 hours. Now, I'm going to be recording with Ethan Johns. Now, you know,
great.
We're going to start off and go to the studio in the real world in Peter Gabriel's studio in Box in Wiltshire,
yeah.
And at which I've recorded many times. And then we'll live there. You know, we'll go in there for a few weeks,
yeah.
and start kicking stuff around, you know, with a rhythm section and see what happens.
Do you ever love a song and then record it and feel like it's not right to release?
Yeah, with Leonard Cohen, for instance, I wanted to do a Leonard Cohen song, and I loved I'm Your Man. So we went in and I thought, oh, I got to do this, you know.
Yeah.
You know, I'll do anything for you. You know, I'll be this and I'll be that, whatever it is, I'm Your Man. And we were all set to do that. And then we tried it, and it was okay, but it wasn't as good as I thought it would be. And then Ethan said, look, if you really like Leonard Cohen, what about Tower of Song? And I said, let me listen. Well, when I heard it, I loved it. And so we then tried it. You know, well, let's try it. And it was great.
Ah, fantastic. Well, thank you so much for doing this. It's such a pleasure. I'm a lifelong fan, and I continue listening. And anytime, and this was an opportunity for us to speak, and I went back and listened to stuff that I haven't listened to recently. And again, every time I hear it, it blows my mind. So thank you.
Oh, good. Well, thank you. And coming from you, that's a compliment, because I've loved the things that you've done, you know, the records that you've made. Tremendous.
Thank you so much.
All right, Rick, take care.
Thanks to Tom Jones for taking us through his incredible career. To hear more of our favorite Tom Jones songs, check out our playlist at BrokenRecordPodcast.com. Be sure to subscribe to our YouTube channel at YouTube.com/BrokenRecordPodcast, where you can find all of our new episodes. You can follow us on Twitter at Broken Record. Broken Record is produced with help from Leah Rose, Jason Gambrell, Ben Tolliday, Eric Sandler, and Jennifer Sanchez, with engineering help from Nick Chafee. Our executive producer is Mia Lobel. Broken Record is a production of Pushkin Industries. If you like this show and others from Pushkin, consider subscribing to Pushkin Plus. Pushkin Plus is a podcast subscription that offers bonus content and uninterrupted ad-free listening for $4.99 a month. Look for Pushkin Plus on Apple Podcast subscriptions. And if you like the show, please remember to share, rate, and review us on your podcast app. Our theme music's by Kenny Beats. I'm Justin Richmond. Did you know some travel credit cards offer 10 times points on your spending? Don't miss out on big rewards for your next trip. NerdWallet lets you compare smart travel credit cards side by side, curated by an expert team of finance nerds. What could future you do with better travel rewards? A free flight? A room upgrade? Don't wait to make smart financial decisions. Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at nerdwallet.com. Reminder, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply. NerdWallet, finance smarter.
Musora is your access to online music lessons for guitar, piano, drums, and singing. This is your chance to reignite some old musical passions or pick up an instrument for the first time. Connect with more than 100 of the world's best teachers and musicians. You'll get 7 days totally free to try it out. And then it's just $30 a month, less than a single private lesson. I mean, why do we do Broken Record? Not just because we love hearing from great musicians. We do it because we think that there is something beautiful about the appreciation of music. Don't you think we need more of that in our lives these days? That's the mission of Musora. To inspire, educate, and connect musicians. Enjoy unlimited personal support, weekly live streams, student lesson plans. It's like having a personal music teacher, only much, much better. Just go to Musora.com, Musora.com, to start a new musical journey today.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.